Welcome to Origins, a podcast about the LP and VC ecosystem. I'm Nick Charles from Notation, joined by my co-host, Beezer Clarkson of Sapphire Partners. Welcome, Beezer.
Hey, good to be here.
You're now really our regular co-host, not a special co-host anymore.
It's my slide sliver plan to be the regular.
We have a guest joining us in a few minutes, Dr. Lan Shui Zhao, the founder of Basiset Ventures, an AI-focused seed firm in SF.
Hey, Lan, thanks for joining Nick and I.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you.
Hi.
So we've relaunched, and by we, really Nick, Origins in a video format because we think everyone should get to see everyone's smiling faces. And what we've been doing is inviting awesome people like yourself to come on and chat with us about current topics, things like this week at Upfront we could chat about since we were all there. How does the market feel now that we're actually legitimately into Q1? And, you know, people are kind of talking about this AI thing. And as someone who's been doing it for a while, we thought it could be fun to talk about that. You do not have to only talk about this. The idea is just to sort of keep it real. But does that sound cool?
Super fun. Let's do it.
Okay. And I'm also going to start this off by saying, first of all, I loved your t-shirt. This was a pre-pandemic t-shirt exchange when I first met Lan. But what you don't know is that I first heard about you back in 2017 when you closed your fund and a couple people pinged me and said, have you heard of this awesome woman doing this fund on machine learning and AI? Why are you not an LP? And they sent me, and we can put this in the podcast notes, the TechCrunch article that came out about you. Do you remember this article?
I remember. So Jiang wrote that article. So I was being very, very secretive because we haven't done anything yet. Raising a fund is just, you know, I haven't done any deals. I didn't feel like we should talk about it. And he just found out about the fund launch from a CC filing, and he reached out. I was super impressed by how he fought me, and then actually hired him. He's my first hire from that. He's a reporter I hired after the fund launch. So it worked out really, really well. And yes. By the way, I just want to say I'm a super big fan of OpenLP, and thank you for all that you've done, and very, very helpful. I, you know, learned a lot from all the articles and great conversations that you've had.
And I'll be sending you a new t-shirt, don't you worry.
Yes.
Nick, you probably need one too. And I have no Origins swag.
Well, we should get Origins swag, but we have beanies. But I don't know if Lan is into the beanies. We also have bags. So we'll send you a bag.
Wow. We're living in California. Bag sounds good.
Okay.
You know, I like my Upfront beanie. I wore it. It was so cool.
Oh, I didn't
in
see
LA.
It.
You had to get your, you just, maybe, oh, maybe it was the LP day. Sorry, it was LP swag. But given it was 45 degrees, the beanie was helpful. So I'm just going to say this because I thought it was so awesome. In sort of thinking about AI, I reread the TechCrunch article, and they basically were back in 17. They were like, oh my God, this is so overhyped. How is there room for one more fund? Do you remember this? When they were asking all these questions and how you're going to be the anti-VC. And I remember reading the article and I was like, I kind of love everything in this article. I can't wait to talk to her.
That's so amazing. In hindsight, 2017 feels like there's no hype for AI compared to the last 6 months. Everyone literally was talking about AI for 6 months now. 2017 feels like the low time. At the time, when I remember I was raising a machine learning AI focused fund, then everyone looked at me and was like, what? You know, it was... And I think there were just a handful of funds launched around that time, only maybe three or four. There are some kind of corporate funds, et cetera. So still kind of in the rare. Now, compared to today, I feel like everyone is doing AI or machine learning or some sort.
What was the thesis then?
So my PhD is around like brain, training brain functions. And I just really, really wanted to focus on figuring out the human mind. You know, start from there. And then I realized there are a lot of basic workflow that just really hard for companies to get right. So the focus really is half of it is around trying to help, you know, figure out the most advanced machine learning AI in offices and kind of in work settings. The other half is trying to help companies automate the basic workflow in factories and farms, et cetera. So it's the spectrum between, you know, basic workflow automation, what we call automation, and the most advanced AI machine learning. So that's the whole spectrum.
And was that informed primarily by your experience at Dropbox?
It was informed by what I did for my PhD, and then I went to McKinsey. It was a pretty sharp contrast for me. It was quite a shock when I was doing super advanced machine learning models, you know, during my PhD, and I went to McKinsey. A lot of the clients were very large tech companies couldn't find where their data is. So the gap between that really, really shocked me. So, you know, and then I realized a lot of the most advanced technology actually doesn't have a use case today. So when you make investment, you got to do kind of across the spectrum, because then other people have, you know, they can pay for it, right? Dropbox was also pretty pivotal because, you know, I feel like I'm very lucky to get to know all the bottom-up SaaS companies around that time. And go-to-market just becomes so powerful, and how people can adopt technology like Dropbox so fast. It just viral. I think it more than anything, it reinforced my desire to make smarter products that can be even adopted even faster in a more kind of tech software fashion. So I think the whole experience just really convinced me that AI machine learning automation is going to transform everything that we will ever do. It's actually a pretty broad thesis back then. And now, you know, I think around that time, people think it's really narrow, but I think it's actually kind of enabler across everything. And it's starting getting true and more true every day.
So if we fast forward to today, do you find half the dialogue that goes on somewhat amusing? Because just for someone who's been in this world for so long, for people now to discover it, does it feel, let me say it even more pointedly, does it feel like if you haven't invested in AI already, it could be too late to start?
No, I think for the past maybe 20 years, there's always AI hype cycles every 4 or 5 years. I feel like this has been going on for a very long time. And even today, we're just barely scratching the surface. Now, there's so much hype around generative AI, which is just one of the areas of AI. There are other areas like, you know, machine learning, NLP, like computer vision. Think about anything, the breakthrough that can come with different areas and for different industries, we're barely scratching the surface. So like in 2017, one of the most common questions I got was, what about these people's jobs you're going to replace? All the people working, you know, like factories or farms, and what about them? Are you going to replace all their jobs? It's evil, right? It's so interesting. 5 years, 6 years later, actually, their jobs are not replaceable. You can still have a major labor shortage, and there's so much more to do in those settings. And quite the opposite, the designers, engineers are getting replaced first. And that's something, you know, like it's just super fascinating to think about how much potential there still is for the 90%, 95% of the real world. Versus like we're so focused on this engineering designer problem and generative AI, it's just actually a very small part of what would be and could be transformed. And what do you guys think? And there's so much talk around AI these days.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point about the focus on generative AI specifically. I think there's many market participants now looking at the hype around generative AI and thinking that is all encompassing of the entire area of focus. One thing I was thinking a little bit about this week at Upfront, and I can't take credit. We were all at Upfront together in LA. It's a great conference every year. They bring everybody out. And one of the things that was interesting was actually said by one of the interviewers was last year was the crypto and Web3 conference effectively at Upfront. And this year, it became effectively a generative AI and machine learning conference. And I wonder if that's actually a decent bottom or top signal in where we are in the hype cycle. So the decision obviously after last year would have been to sell all the crypto. And so I worry about this year, we're sort of at the top of that hype cycle. And I agree with you, Beezer, that if you have not been investing in this category for the last number of years, to use crypto terminology, aping into it now is probably maybe not the right time. Maybe now is actually the time to learn if there's a really long, if you're committed to the category and there's a very large long-term opportunity, maybe now is the time to learn. But curious how you guys think about it as well.
Is it not the time to invest because it's just overpriced for what you're getting? Or do you need to be expert enough in what's how to price something that if you need, sort of like crypto, you have to be able to understand and study it. And AI is not obvious, at least not obvious to me. So I wouldn't know how to price some of these deals. So I'm assuming expertise helps lead to that. Or what, why are you saying it's not the time to do it? Too many people running after it is just
going to be. I'd be curious to hear Lan's perspective, but from our perspective as pre-seed investors, we have several AI investments that we've made over the last number of years. One of which is in generative, and no one was sort of uninvestable 18 months ago when we did it. They just raised another very hot round recently. So for us as pre-seed investors, the hype is so significant now that particularly in generative, you're seeing kind of crypto valuations from a year or two ago. So you're seeing seed rounds getting raised at, you know, $7 million rounds on $50 million valuations. And that for us specifically does not support our model. But what I found with other hype cycles and other categories is at some point that hype cycle ends. You get rid of a lot of the noise. If you've done the learning during the hype period of the cycle, years later, whether 1, 2, 3 years later when it ends, there's typically a lot of really interesting companies that come out of it at fairly priced valuations. So right at this moment, I'm sort of in wait and see mode on generative AI. And but believe it's a huge opportunity and I'm spending a lot of time learning. So I'm curious to hear Lan's perspective, particularly as someone that's just a touch maybe later at seed and in early A.
Yeah, I think devil's in the details. We have 4 generative AI companies. And the valuation for when we're investing or from 5 to 9 post. Today, you're not getting that. I think, you know, catching the wave before it gets super obvious is pretty important for early stage investors. I think now generative AI is at a place where it is very expensive, but there are many other AI areas that are super investable. You can get much lower valuation. Robotics is one of them. It's actually pretty fascinating to getting early, getting low before the way become obvious. And I have no doubt technology will evolve so much that every single area will take off in the next, you know, 6 months, 1 year. I think that's the first. And second, around generative AI, around these models, what exactly are you investing in? There are all these foundational models. It's going to be so commoditized. In six months to a year, there's going to be 5, 6 models coming out. Everyone's going to do this. Any large company, any way in the US and in China have the capability will do this. So what, as early stage investor, what are we investing in, right? There are companies coming out raising $10, $40 million seed round to build some of the models. Is that the bet to make? Or are we investing in applications building on top of any of these models? Or are we investing in tissues connecting these models with enterprise companies? So a lot of the nuances into like exactly where we place the bets, where can we get the ownership, where can we find the alpha, even within generative AI. I find it super fascinating to think about these questions and, you know, getting at the right place at the right time for the right ownership with the right founder. It's like a treasure hunting. It's pretty fascinating.
I love it too. Yeah, I agree that our job, particularly as pre-seed investors, is to make investments in companies that might be of interest several years later. Yes. Or categories that might be of interest several years later. I'm curious, Lan, on that last point, because we've been doing a lot of thinking on this, is do you have any early hunches, particularly in generative, how value might accrue in the stack over time? Because I think that's one of the most difficult pieces to sort of figure out now. And a lot of folks are looking at OpenAI and stability. Totally. And maybe even those platforms will be commoditized over time. So it's not just the apps, yes, but even the platforms. So I'm 100%. Curious to hear maybe if there's an internal view at BasisSet, yeah, how value accrues across the stack.
I mean, the platform, I think about as just these models. These models will be commoditized. I don't think it will even take very long. You'll give it 6 months and, you know, it will be completely commoditized. So at the same time, the use cases aren't that clear. Companies are doing anything from support to chatbots to note-taking to art generation to there's a whole spectrum of use cases that are being explored right now. I'm seeing very early stage tractions from a bunch of these companies, but which one can be sustainable, can charge a lot of money? And I think that's still a question mark. So personally, I'm not spending a lot of time looking at these platform models because I believe they will be commoditized so much that, you know, is there big competition across the big players and whoever have the most money. I'm spending a lot of time either on the application layer to find the real use cases or building specialized vertical models within specific vertical or can personalize some of these models in specific settings. We have companies doing that or some infrastructure tools that make it easier and cheaper or to connect tissues between the models and applications. So those are areas we spend more time on. I think that's where we'll get more alpha.
How do you think about one other area we've just been discussing internally at Notation is how incumbents leverage some of the recent advances. So just using customer service as an example, we're seeing a lot of customer service applications at seed and A. Is maybe an incumbent like a Zendesk actually best positioned to implement some of these new models, yeah, and new technology? Obviously that's easier said than done, particularly at large organizations that struggle with organizational change, but curious how you think about that.
I think they certainly have a lot of advantages and disadvantages. Like they have so much data. If they want to train their own personalized model based on the model available, they'll actually be in a stronger position because they know the customer workflow so well. They know what customer wants. You can't just take GTP and specific plugin and for it ready to use, right? Because it lies a lot. It has all sorts of, you have to have different guardrails for that to work really well, especially for industries like banks and, you know, regular industries, it just can't directly use. So for existing players, if they're able to use their own existing data workflow and integrate with these foundation models, I think they're at a good place, a stronger position. Unfortunately, I think a lot of companies, it's just hard for them to move fast, innovate, and kind of ignore what's already working and move to something that's almost completely new. I think that's where startup has new opportunities, like building something new, sometimes actually easier and faster than having to tear down a house or remodel, right? So I think that's where I'm pretty excited about the startups, building, especially for specific verticals. If you're building like customer support chat tool for banks, almost certainly you can't use like existing. You have to do something pretty different. I think those are the areas I think is pretty fascinating for smaller companies to go into.
Can I take what you just said and bridge to a different topic? Because one of the things you and I have talked about, you know, going off the anti-VC comment in the article, and something that Nick and I talk about a lot, which is the evolution of venture. And what does a venture fund look like 2 years from now, 5 years from now? What is it that you think you guys do? And maybe it's different today than back then that is sort of like the newer. I don't want to steal any of your thunder because you've told me things in the past, but I think it's fascinating. So I'd be curious how you think of yourself as an anti-VC today.
I mean, to be honest, I didn't give myself that name. I think John just made it up and I actually read it for the first time from the article. I don't know. I think he was surprised that I met him at the Puchero outside of a coffee shop versus the Battery, right? I think I didn't even know what Battery was at that time. I grew up super poor. I didn't even know what VC was until pretty recently. So I think a couple of things I'm curious about what you think is interesting from your point of view, obviously, from the LP point of view. I think the new seed landscape and the new school venture just different. Like in the past, you can invest 10 of your best friends and, you know, like it's so value is so concentrated in a small group of people that, you know, they generate most of the value. Today, it's never been easier and cheaper and more, you know, everything is so distributed in a way that anyone can build a large company anywhere almost, right? And talent also migrates to different places. And the volume of seed stage companies, it's like grow like this. We look at the data, it's kind of like this. So as an early stage venture fund, you have to be able to figure out a way to deal with that market. Because if you pick and choose this still small group of people, then the chances of hitting something consistently is really, really hard. So what we try to do is to build that consistency into venture. That means system, scalability, focus, right? We'll focus on specifically what we do really well. We build systems and structures that help us scale in a way that, you know, the productivity per investor is like growing like this as the venture landscape grows. And we build the culture, so you know, in a way that kind of scales that way as well. At the same time, fund size doesn't scale, right? So we want to generate better return for each fund. And so that's how I think about it. And, you know, there are a lot of nuancing to that. I'm curious about, you know, how you think, Bisa.
Well, I try to characterize it this way. Like when I talk to you and you talk about building your processes and your systems, I remember like you got up one night and coded one of them and you're like, oh, we need X. So I'm just going to build it. Said probably no venture capitalist ever 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And I think this is kind of part of you knew how to do it one, so that's just different. And then thinking through how is this then usable to create a process that is just a whole different mindset, which doesn't mean to say somebody couldn't learn how to do it, even like someone as old as me. But like it just, the initial way of thinking about it just comes at it with a really different lens. And you and I have talked a lot about everyone thinks they hustle, but then how do you hustle in this world that's not just getting on a plane, but it includes getting on a plane, but you can't do it as a one-off. So it is that synthesis of all these things. It just feels very different. The energy is just a different world. And you tell me if you like your entrepreneurs, that's not my place to judge, but it's interesting. I don't know. And Nick uses a different process. So it's, I find it all.
Yeah. I'm curious about the scalability. And cause I was reading a little bit about BasisSet before this as well. And, like particularly as it relates to sourcing and some of the portfolio company support stuff, I'm curious, like one, where and how you think tools make sense for certain parts of the firm.
Yeah.
And then selfishly, if you can give us just a little bit of a preview on what exactly those tools look like, that'd be awesome.
I don't think they look like yours, Nick.
No, yeah. I don't think so either.
Bizarre, I've seen it. I mean, I think I'm, you know, like, this is pros and cons. I didn't know what VC was like. I just, you know, let's just build what makes sense in this new market. Like going back to our conversation of building something completely new with a different mindset, different principle, sometimes it's easier if you're actually looking outside in. And it was like, you know, didn't know what a, my background is completely different. You know, I got my PhD. I grew up so poor that, you know, like I have to turn everything, I have to make everything from scratch. Just something that I had to do and it's a habit. And I built first version of the system at Dropbox where we found Musical.ly, ByteDance that has nothing to do with Dropbox. But it was so fascinating that we're able to see that in 2014, 2015. So it works. It's such a out of network company that we met plenty of great companies at Dropbox, but this is not something you would meet, you know, on a daily basis. So that kind of insight and alpha requires just a different approach. So that was one of the aha moments, like, wow, this actually works. And I think one day a large VC came and asked me to build a system for them and, you know, they'll pay for it. And then I thought about it. Actually, if we can find a company, I can make $100 million. I don't want to make, you know, $50,000 to sell the tool versus can just to build a firm to do this. But the way I think about system tools is it's kind of like airman's suit, right? You don't make decisions. Humans still make decisions, but with this tool set, with this suit, you'll do it better. You'll see further, you know, fly higher, you have more power, have more energy. So that's how I think about kind of enabling investors to be better. You'll not make a bad investor be a good investor, but you'll make a good investor be a much better investor. So that's how I think about it. Specifically, we built a lot of sourcing a capability where we integrate with a lot of obvious and unobvious data sources. We have a bunch of deals that we would never, otherwise would never meet. One of a couple of founders, I don't know if you guys know Braxton Fun, who's founder of Series Financial. I cold emailed him in 2018. I say our machine found you, and he showed up and was completely out of my network back then. And Viscon's another founder who we found in Fund 2, drove from Michigan to Menlo Park, have no mutual connection. This is one of our generative AI company. So it just enables us to find opportunities, founders, otherwise are completely out of our network. I'm going to not talk about how we, integrate what data source and how we integrate the data sources. The other element is workflow automation. So like I would be able to take 5 meetings a day with founders who, and with no work on my end. And they would just show up on my calendar because our tool is good enough to make that efficient. Ultimately, it's a funnel conversion, right? You have to meet certain number of founders and diligence and get into deals and closing. As we scale our tools and capabilities, the quality gets better. We'll still do the same number of deals per fund, but you'll have to believe as the world changes, we'll be able to cover better and the consistency gets better over time. So that's really what we're solving for.
I've always found I do a lot of outbound outreach, which I think is important for every 100%. Venture capitalist in the market today. You can't just sit and hope that folks are going to come to you, I guess, unless you're maybe Sequoia or something. Yes. But even they do a lot of outbound.
Sequoia's and, aggressive outbound. Actually,
totally.
Yes. Yeah.
Totally. But I've always found in the past, and I've thought about automating, or we've even tried like automating emails, and I've always found that the personal touch is just so important in finding the person, or not even necessarily finding the person, but creating a relationship and setting up a meeting. So one thing I noticed actually on your website was that there was some line about how, we use AI, but then like we care about empathy and humans. And so I'm curious, maybe without speaking about the very specific details, like how you marry those two things.
I think there are things you can automate and there are things you can't. I think by automating more and better actually leaves time for you to be more empathetic with founders. So one of the things is like when I started being a VC, actually just, in corp dev at Dropbox, I spent all the time making intros, so many intros to make. And you just, these emails, it takes a long time to write. I mean, that's something that's very automatable. And that's one of the things we automated completely almost. And founders can go into the system and find self-serve intros and it's double opt-in, but takes us out of the process. So that for automating things like this, that really leaves a lot of time for me to take these phone calls. I don't have I'm sure you do, these text messages. Do you have 2 minutes to talk today? Always something that takes an hour. And, so like,
That's true.
Always like, emergency of some sort that may or may not be actual emergencies, but founders just freak out in some ways, right? Like, so then I'll have time to take these calls and respond super fast. And I think Smear has a tweet a couple of days ago, like one of the best quality emerging managers, they respond within hours. An hour is too long. You have to respond within 20 seconds. When someone texts you, you have 2 minutes to talk today. If you say today, you got to respond, in the next 30 seconds. I think otherwise you run out of capacity. I think you have to automate things that are actually scalable and leverage other people, like operators, experienced people to help the founders problem solve, like how to, draft KPIs or something like that, they're better at doing, so that we can use our time to solve the completely unscalable, oftentimes emotional challenges. And that's honestly where trust and equity is actually built during hard times.
I want to also say I really experienced, you've had a new space. So I haven't seen the new space, full disclosure, but I'm sure it's got all sorts of similar energy in it, that your space was empathetic. Like you thought about how people needed to use space in a way that said, like, you've got your life going on and how do you share your life with this space? Not, you can explain it. Cause again, I think it's always best when people use their own words, but you expressed all those things physically as well. Even during COVID, when you thought about your truck van concept. And Nick will appreciate this because Nick also, I've always experienced notation physically in their space as well. It's a different vibe. It's a different sense because your cultures are just different, but it's very clear that you're dealing with somebody who's thinking for themselves.
I feel like we grow up.
I want to hear the truck van.
The truck van.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Keep going.
Yeah, no, sorry. At some point, I want to turn the parking lot into a climbing wall with a truck. So like at some point during COVID, the founders are all over the place. They don't go to office anymore. So we're like, hey, why don't we turn into our office in a van? We just drive to wherever they are. It was actually, ultimately didn't happen. Too much liability. Who's driving that van? Do you have workers?
Can I tell you, I had an LP meeting at a conference in a Sprinter van in Berlin. Shout out to Philip at Tiny VC because he was like, hey, they want to charge like some ridiculous amount of money to go inside and have a coffee. And he's like, we have the Sprinter van that we're taking on a family vacay. Like, is it cool if we meet in the Sprinter van? He's got a table. It's got coffee. I was like, sure. I'm like, pull up out front. So you're not wrong. It was awesome.
It's a great idea until you start thinking about the compliance and risks involved with this driver and driving a van, you know, the security in San Francisco and all of the stuff. But it's a great idea. The space is built. Initially, I raised my funds solo in 2017. I was 5 months pregnant. I took 5 days of maternity leave. I deal with myself that year. And I have to manage my kids. So the first version of office have a playground in the office. I think it just out of necessity. I would take meetings and with founders over the weekends when my kids would play in the office. And I would just lock myself in the room where the founders have meetings. So that's what born out of necessity, but actually created a lot of empathy for people going through you know, like times like that. I remember Wall Street Journal, they were trying to figure out some other topics and they walked into my office and decided to make this the highlight of their article. Even when we launched Fund 2, we reached out to Wall Street Journal to see if they want to cover Fund 2 launch. It was a pretty, you know, sizable fund, but the title of the Fund 2 launch was Business That Closes Its Office as it launches $165 million. It's like the office actually made a bigger impact around that time, just because of how different and empathetic it was for people who are going through at least that stage of life. My kids are older now, you know, we don't need it, but like the concept, I think really people appreciate that. There are other things we've done, you know, like founders want to find customers and we'll just put all the founders together in the same building. You just go talk to other founders to see if they want to buy your products. That's one simple thing that we've done and, you know, benefit from founders to get customers at least testing super easily. We now scaled this on Slack with a couple of our communities where founders can get help from other founders, hundreds of them now, to test other products. Things like this. And I feel like when you're building a new firm, you have a lot of degree of freedom to test out different things that has never been done. It's frankly just a little bit easier because there's no existing structure that prevent you from doing that. And just like, what do you need the founder? We're going to build this for you because we're growing up with you at the same time. I think that really helped a lot.
And you also had other VCs in your space.
Yes.
I remember the founder wall of like stuff, right? Yes. So you could go through and see stuff.
Yes.
And you had co-working space for your founders and you had VCs who were all awesome. I liked all of them as people.
Yes. I think you're LPs in some of them. Great friends.
You think I was LPs in all of them at the time.
So I picked well.
You must have similar taste.
It was really, really convenient, I would say. A founder would come in and pitch multiple VCs. And sometimes I remember one of the VCs was Billy, Two Sigma. I was talked to a founder who mentioned Two Sigma was a client. I just walked out the door, Billy, you're the client. Tell me how good is your user experience. That was so convenient around that time. There's definitely synergy. The VCs you'll trust and want to work together and share deal flow, definitely a lot of value add. Great VCs. And sometimes hear the conversation. It was like, oh, this is interesting. This is how you win deals. that's, you know, learn something from it.
I don't know, Nick, we've talked about collaboration and venture a little. What's your thought?
I have so many thoughts on that, but I guess I'll share a little bit, which is I kind of think that the venture world is sort of bifurcating. We've seen that. Maybe that changes a little bit in the next couple of years as the market slows down, but gigantic, huge firms on one side, many different fund types, building platforms, people, unlimited capital, brand. I actually think they have one of the biggest advantages they have. I actually think they have great information in all different markets across all different sectors. What they don't have is, quite frankly, like a lot of what we've seen from land today is hustle, building it from the ground up, building it from first principles, owning your own business. Many of the people that work at these big platforms are, no offense to any of them, they're employees. And I've been very interested in the last couple of years around how you could incentivize many of the small firms, and I'm talking about really small firms, like more like notation, sub $50 million, to collaborate in a way that creates some of the advantages that you'd feel in a big firm, but allows you to keep your autonomy, keep your brand, and keep your what makes you great, which is small and nimble, and you own your own business. So I won't say too much more just yet, but that's been my recent obsession.
What would be the one thing you think small firm can collaborate on?
I think there's many things, but like one of the things that you're doing that I think is quite interesting is thinking about how to grow the network for founders. So adding network across all the different founders and relationships that you've built, and maybe even other VCs in your office. I think that many firms, particularly very small firms in different geos and different sectors, they're not really directly competitive and can build networks together. Can share information and deal flow together. So those are just two obvious ones.
You know, on that point, did you see Hunter Walk, who I think is now back on Twitter? news alert. He posted this thing about the you don't need a warm intro. And there was, I don't know, 10 or 15 VCs. And they were going to, I may have the details wrong. We can put in the speaker notes. But you as a founder can send in your, I guess it's a business plan or an email. And then any one of these VCs could look at it and respond, which is not the same thing you're talking about, Nick, but it's a little bit of a version of there's ways of collaborating that probably take advantage of the of synergy versus cutthroat sharp elbows, right?
Totally. And I think the last piece I would say is actually just teamwork. So many of these small firms are run by solo GPs, tiny little teams. They actually like to collaborate, but they don't necessarily want full-time partners at their firm. And so actually, again, many of the things that Lan was doing at her office with other VCs, there are these informal collaborations. I think you can even formalize some of those collaborations without having them be full-time partners with one another.
Yeah, building a company is hard. They can, you know, use leverage help from multiple funds, and right? So that helps the company. Over time.
Can I ask as part of that, where's the market now? I know you're pre-seed, Nick, so you're potentially a smaller check, but maybe not than what Lan's doing in her fund. Because when you, it's sort of like I don't know today, maybe it's different, like between this big seed, but not yet A, and I don't know, the world's shifting, right? We're sort of recalibrating and finding our footing. Are those both still very collaborative spaces, like today, March 2023, or not if you're generative AI and you're everybody else?
I feel like it depends on the VC, whether they're collaborative or not. If it's a large fund, they want to have their ownership, right? Smaller funds, it's a lot easier to be collaborative. I feel like the market is really active in Q1. I feel like Q4 was a little bit slow, but Q1 is very active, especially in AI, machine learning. But overall, I feel like there's kind of a little bit of a growth and coming back. I don't know what you guys feel, but that's, you know, I feel like it's coming back a little bit. from kind of where I stand. At the same time, the valuation is lower. Although for some of the more consensus-driven companies and founders, does actually have not much to do with how great a company is, just consensus-driven, then they're still pretty expensive. I would say the most, for most of the companies, valuation have come down quite a bit. What are you seeing?
I'm curious. I feel like, Lan, you're in some ways, maybe your view of the market is like distorted, given you're operating in a market that is very busy. And through that lens, I'm kind of curious how you think about advising founders, because we now have all this information from the broader market that says, hey, actually, maybe don't raise at the most aggressive valuation. Maybe don't raise as much money as you can. And then you have AI, which has those opportunities today in a way that other companies in other sectors maybe had those opportunities 18 months ago. And so in some ways they have an advantage because they've have new learnings from all these companies in other sectors that have maybe done all the wrong things in the last 18 months, spent too much money, raised too much money. And so maybe even just using some of your generative AI companies, because I imagine those are kind of frothy right now, or they're getting offers to raise tons of money at crazy valuations. How are you and the founders that you work with working through that, given the information in other parts of the market?
I think it really depends on the founders. There are founders who are super lean. If they're able, they're offered cash, I'll say take it. There are founders who, if I think they, with the more cash, comes with more risks because it makes them, you know, harder to focus on the right things. So pay people more, burn higher, less likely to find part market fit. I absolutely don't take that. You know, of all the founders, obviously the valuation, we want them to be reasonable because we also have to consider our pro rata. The valuation is not reasonable, then we don't do our pro rata. If it's super reasonable, I think that's, you know, it set the founder up for success. I would say, unfortunately, not all founders would, you know, think long term. Some founders will not do that. My advice for founders always don't think 6 months ahead. Think 5 years, 10 years ahead. Always make the long term decision, because some of the short term decisions will always come back and hunt you at the end. There are founders who, like, I'm pretty direct. I'll tell them, you don't have part market fit, don't race. And, you know, like, think about this and potentially even return cash. And, you know, I'll have that conversation. Sometimes some founders appreciate it. Some founders will, you know, appreciate 6 months later. So some founder will not appreciate it. And, you know, like, we'll make a call with which founder can survive in the market.
You just made me think of we're seeing a couple situations now, which remind me of venture 10 years ago when I first started. So I worked with a company a very long time ago, pre-notation, at Betaworks. They launched the product. It didn't work. They had another year and a half, 2 years of runway. They thought about new products that they could build. They came in, they repitched the partnership at Betaworks for that new product idea. And we all made a decision together around whether or not to continue forward. And they were open to returning the money if the investors weren't really excited about the new idea. That totally went away and disappeared.
That's
from the market
so
in the last
hard to
number
do
of
this
years.
Market. Exactly.
But I think I'm seeing it again. So I'm seeing it again.
Yeah. You're seeing it again. I think that depends on the founders. Yeah. Really depends on the founders. The easy thing to not return a cash and just keep it is just easy thing to do.
Well, I think it also, in the recent years, founders didn't even know that was an option. Because VCs would just be like, just keep going, whatever. Yeah. Just find something new. Someone else will fund it. Just keep going. And we've had a couple conversations at Notation recently where we're starting to think about it in that same way. And oddly enough, I think the founders appreciate it, right? Because you don't want to be a founder sort of just like going through 20 different ideas and it's sort of stressful figuring out what the right market and idea is, and you're burning cash in the meantime. And so they've been a couple hard conversations, but founders, I think in the end actually appreciate like, hey, this is actually an option. Didn't work. Totally. No hard feelings. Worked your ass off. We have half the money in the bank. We can return it. Or there's this new thing that we're all really excited about. And let's all embark on that together. Totally. So I was just curious if you were seeing it because you mentioned a story about thinking about whether or not a founder was returning cash or something like that.
Well, I think it depends on situation. We have one founder actually pivoted 20 times and found Part Market Fit. And I love
that. God.
This is Rudder. They wrote it publicly on Twitter. They actually pivoted 20 times and they found Part Market Fit. They're doing well. Raised Series A. So, I mean, if they you have that, you know, persistent, you think you can't find Part Market Fit, I think go for it, right? We're super supportive. I think there are founders who wouldn't have that velocity. They're kind of checked out a little bit. They don't know if they can keep going. They just don't want to return a cash because it's just easier and more comfortable thing to do. I think that becomes a little bit harder. And I used to be in corp dev. I've seen so many of these companies trying to get acquired when they don't have Part Market Fit. A lot of times in founders' head, oh, if we don't find Part Market Fit, we can always get acquired by so-and-so. Well, guess what? That never happens. Never happens. The chance of M&A is like a fraction of a chance of getting funding. And most M&A don't even work. Even if you make it work, most of the times it's acqui-hire. It's basically just a package. You're able to see, to say on your resume, you got acquired, but really like no one's getting anything, the founders included. So, I mean, founders are hoping that's going to happen, so they keep going. But really, like, I think you're right. Having direct conversation with founders, what are the options available? And have them really kind of assess their motivation and the right path forward. That's something I think every founder and investor in that situation should do.
So, I have so many questions about this M&A thing. Because everyone does say this. Like, you are 100% right. And given this situation we have right now where a lot of companies have raised a ton of significant amount of capital, may or may not have product market fit. So you can keep doing the doing, but at some point, everything you've said is accurate, both of you two. And we hear like, oh, well, acquisitions aren't happening, probably because there isn't product market fit and who knows what the right price is. So if you just, not to be held to this, no one has a perfect crystal ball. But do we think we're going to see M&A pick up this year? And I'm not talking like the Figma ginormous one. I'm talking about just the general stuff that used to clear portfolios out and add on different things to companies. Like, do we see any signs of that or is it crickets?
I think it's crickets. Companies do M&A when they have the cash, they have the reason. You know, I think companies will do probably a little bit more M&A, but it's not that public companies, large companies are in a good spot. They don't have that much runway or leeway to, like Salesforce, and they just shut down their M&A team or something, or maybe it's like something of that flavor. I think I probably am not describing correctly, but I think larger companies are not in a great position to pay to do these. M&A's ultimately really, really hard. Do you think about from a large company point of view, how do I make sense of this? Is it talent acquisition, product acquisition, or is this a market expansion, right? If it's talent acquisition, okay, you're not getting paid. We're just hiring the people directly. So it doesn't make any difference. If you're product acquisition, your product will have to work. We'll have to have synergy with existing product they have. Atlassian's pretty famous for and Salesforce acquiring a lot of different products and they can put in the same product suite and get the viral cross-sell capabilities. And that is super rare. You have to have Part Market Fit. You have to have a fit with this specific company. And you have to be able to drive that additional revenue that make this company more valuable. And that's really, really tough, right? And then market expansion, you have to be in a strategic market that this company is willing to expand to. And honestly, we're in a time where most companies just like struggling to meet their target. They're not even like aggressively expanding across different market. Some will, but most, I don't think they're thinking about that. So like if you think from that point of view, like it is really, really hard to make anything work. So, you know, it's really never been more important to just have a very accurate view on what the future is like. Hope is not a strategy. You can't hope that this is going to get a crisis. It's not going to happen. So like, you know, be really realistic on what is happening? Do you have a market fit or not? And what is, you know, path going forward? You either iterate 20 times, find market fit, or probably just do the right thing, return your cash. And guess what? The next time, the investor will still fund you. It doesn't matter if you fail, because everyone understands that just part of the business. It matters way more how you fail and how you like go through that process and treat everyone, you know, like with respect and do the right thing.
So last, I have one last question for Beezer, which is, in a world in which there's no M&A and no companies going public.
We have a term for this. That, you know what the term
what
is?
What does that mean for us? Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say more from an LP standpoint. This is the plight
more
of the
from
LP. Because you can't manufacture exits anyway as an LP. You're on for the ride, right? Like it doesn't even matter. Put it this way, back in the bull market when there was options, there were still a lot of non-exiting happening and the LPs couldn't do anything about it anyway. So we're on for the ride. But no, this is partially why you're hearing some consternation from LPs, because you have to assume much less liquidity. Everyone can assume their own what version of less versus zero for the next, I don't know, 12, 18 months. I'm not a banker. I don't know when the IPO market's going to open, but even fewer companies IPO than M&A. So I know there's a backlog from what you hear, but everyone can't go out tomorrow, unfortunately. So yeah, it's tricky. And this is where you're seeing the continued discussion we've been having on LPs, just having to sort of sort their portfolios mm-hmm. in the backdrop of there's not money enough coming back. Because a lot of times it's nice if you return the capital, I put it back in your fund. There's a nice little round robin. That's not happening so much. And it's not happening. We don't do publics or buyouts, so I don't have perfect visibility. But when I talk to other LPs, and shout out to Upfront again for being an amazing convening of LPs, GPs, and founders, I don't think they're seeing a ton in other places, because unless your stocks are up, this is not the market that you want to be taking cash out of the public market to then put into something else. At least that's what they tell me. Again, not our book of business. But. So yes.
The market will come back though. So who can survive that long? That's the winner.
Isn't that always the case? Like the market can outweigh. Exactly. What's the quote? It's something about you need to hold on to your money. The market can be down longer than you can hold on to your money or something.
If we make it work, then yes. That's the biggest winner. So I think, like, people always think about the market's tough, hard to raise money. But then I'll just tell founders, actually, you always have to be the 1%, top 1% to have the outsized return. It's actually better in this market. You have an accurate reflection of where you are. The market a couple years ago, it's not the case that 99% company will make it. No, that's never been the case. You still have to be top 1%. You just don't know who's top 1%. Now, I kind of feel like it's easier, more clear for founders. Now we're seeing like the quality founders going up, because the founders who aren't really meant to do this, they are not starting company in this market. So I kind of feel like the optimistic view is like, if you're meant to do this, if you're top 1%, you're going to survive this. You have the biggest price at the end.
Yes. And the other half of the equation that I heard from a lot of LPs this past week was that feels true going forward, but what's in my portfolio that exactly. We really don't know. You guys might know, but like the information is very delayed coming back in. So like people say, like, how are you valuing your portfolio? And they're like, it's just very, very hard because yes.
Take a hard look, go through every company. I guess it's a little bit like, from LP point of view, I don't know. Would LP take a more aggressive approach and just say, hey, this company is too expensive, let's just mark it down?
I don't think LPs can dictate people to mark down, but I think there's definitely a lot of conversations going on. And we've definitely, as an N-of-1, switched to understanding better where product market fit is within a company versus just the how many months of cash do you have, which is not an unimportant metric, but it doesn't answer the product market fit. So we're asking that more and more. So apologies in advance. You might hear it.
Oh, I already, we have a very beautiful dashboard with all that information. We go through that internally already. It's clickable and with audited financial information.
All right. We got to cut this off now before Lan starts making us all look even worse.
It's a great place to deal with you on Zoom, but can't send it to you yet.
Okay. Oh, awesome. Love it. Love it. Well, thank you for joining us. It's awesome to catch up. It was great to see both of you live. Shout out to In Real Life as well as on video, Zoom.
So good to see you both. So
thanks so much, Nan. Thanks, Beezer.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye.